ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're the Prime Minister. What's your first move? Make Australia a green energy superpower. Fix the housing crisis. Treat mental health as a national priority. The economy, stupid, is talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Well, we're just a few weeks into 2026, and already, Gerry, there's a couple of things going on in the world. We've already had the Trump administration seizing the president of Venezuela.
We're bringing Venezuela back, and we're going to be great for Venezuela, great for our country.
And they're already talking about what other countries might be next, with Greenland and Cuba essentially being told to look out.
Yeah, look, if I lived in Havana and I was in the government, I'd be concerned.
And in the midst of all of this, there are these huge protests unfolding in Iran.
Look, it's not the first time people there have taken to the streets. We all know that. But the sheer scale of what we're seeing has prompted the question, could this be the end of the current regime in Iran?
There might be a little bit to talk about in 2026. G'day, I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and welcome to the new daily Global Roaming.
Well, if you're worried, Geraldine, there wouldn't be enough to talk about with a daily edition of Global Roaming. I think the first few weeks of 2026 might have laid those fears somewhat. There is so much unfolding in almost every direction.
Look, I just think it's sort of full-on turbulence. I don't know what you were thinking about on your long holiday, but I was traversing Australia. I went across the continent on the big train, and the Venezuela thing happened while I was on the train. And I was sitting there thinking, well, this is exactly what Hamish and I are going to be talking about. We're genuinely coming to terms with super turbulence, I think.
Yeah, and look, I should say I tried to switch off a little bit. You know, it was hard to do, though, because the news just kept penetrating. And I think that's in part why we're so excited to be welcoming a couple of new hosts who we're going to introduce you to towards the end of this episode. Kylie Morris will be here, Latika Burke as well. We're delighted to have them on board so that Global Roaming can become a daily program. Our focus, though, today, Gerry, is going to be Iran, because really that's the story of the moment. And I suppose if you haven't been necessarily locked on to the news, I know I tried to take a break from it and just sort of do the ocean swims and the bushwalks over summer and not be relentlessly receiving the intravenous drip of news. The protests started towards the end of December. It was when the Iranian riyal plunged to a record low against the US dollar. And interestingly, these protests started in the historic bazaars in Tehran.
Which prompted the arrival of the Iranian Revolution in the first place back in 79.
Yeah, inevitably a fierce response from the Iranian regime, immediate crackdown, threats of hangings, deaths on the streets, and of course the Trump administration weighing in fairly unpredictable style.
Yes, and the question is, undoubtedly the wars last year in June, July, when the Israelis and the Americans bombed and penetrated the whole of Iran in an extraordinary fashion and sort of decapitated the entire sort of leadership of the Revolutionary Guards Corps, that has undoubtedly weakened Iran.
And on top of that, the success from the point of view of Washington, the Trump administration, of taking out Maduro in Venezuela. Now, plenty of very legitimate criticism about that. This is in no way an endorsement of it, but they will see that they got in and got out relatively quickly and they were able to affect the outcome that they desired.
But that's exactly the risk, I think, at the moment, is that you move one regime to another, as it were. And that's, you know, I listened over the holidays to that Hugh White, that recommendation we had from Peter Varghese in our summer program.
The 4.5 hour podcast.
I listened
Geraldine.
To it. I gardened to it.
I tried about 2 hours.
It was really good.
About I know how you love Hugh White. I listened to it thinking to myself, surely Geraldine doesn't love Hugh White that much that she'll listen to this whole thing.
Oh, I thought, oh, I've gone Joe Rogan, you know, I'm prepared to listen to 4 hours. But I did. But, you know, his point is that, and I thought he made a pretty pretty well. Big countries, big powers can sleepwalk into war. And I think the Americans have got to be very careful now that what they pulled off, as it were, in Venezuela is not necessarily what they're going to be able to do in Iran. But that's exactly what we're trying to focus on.
I just don't think we can go past this conversation, though, without noting all of Trump's promises to take America out of the world.
I know.
The sort of unilateralism isolationism, whatever, however you want to characterise it, he's now taken out the leader of Venezuela. He's threatening to go into Iran, in the Middle East, where he was so critical of previous US governments of getting involved.
He's not an isolationist. I think it's becoming increasingly clear, that idea that he was going to sort of quietly pull back to the Western Hemisphere.
In any event, let's set up the interview that you've done with Barbara Slavin. A really big question is that, if this Iranian regime collapses one way or another, what happens next? Is it someone like Pahlavi, the son of the last Shah, who's been in exile for many years, absolutely no record of running anything, really? Is it another cleric? Is it a power struggle within the Revolutionary Guard or other factions? These are the really big challenges that would confront any other power in terms of weighing whether or not to get involved.
Now, Barbara Slavin, we thought, was a perfect person to talk to us about this. She's a former journalist. She's now an expert on Iran, and she's a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center in Washington. So what is it that Iranians themselves would most like to see? It's such an important question. Here's Barbara now.
The solution for Iran that most Iranians would like to see would be a constitutional referendum that would tone down or eliminate clerical control and allow elected institutions to run the country, elected president, elected parliament. Iran has the bones of a democracy if it were allowed to actually, you know, rely on them. But how we get from here to there, you know, that's a really hard thing to envision at this point.
So when President Trump has been saying help is on its way, is that wanted? You know, in your judgment, I mean, obviously there's huge different views, but do you think it is welcomed?
No, I think it's welcomed by a lot of people. The question is, you know, is he just leading them on? You know, what can he practically do to help them change their situation? This is the same guy who has banned Iranians from coming to the United States, who has expelled hundreds of Iranians who are already in this country back to Iran. You know, he's not exactly someone who appears to really care about people's well-being. He has, of course, slapped on sanction after sanction. And these economic sanctions have been one of the reasons that the Iranian economy is in such dire straits. Obviously, mismanagement and corruption also, but a lot of them fed by sanctions. So he's an odd person to be saying that he's on his way with help.
Well, have they ruined it? Let me ask you the other way. Is it possible that it would have had more momentum if it was not clear that the Americans and the Israelis wanted, regime change?
Well, I think a lot of Iranians would like regime change. The question is, to what and how do they get there? If it's via a civil war and it ends up with just another dictator, at the end of the day, whether a military officer or the, you know, son of the former Shah, I think that's unlikely, frankly. Will it have been worth it if there is a huge death toll, much more than we've already seen? I think these are things that people are considering and are weighing. And the government, as I said, cracked down very hard and very fast this time. Breathtakingly so. And I think there appears to be a bit of a lull now. People are, you know, absorbing the shocks. They're burying their dead. It's quite terrifying for them. And yes, they like the moral support they're hearing from Donald Trump, but they also understand that he has a short attention span, that he's busy with Venezuela and Greenland and Lord knows what else. And that he doesn't want to get involved in a protracted war in the Middle East. So how much can they really count on his promises?
Does it represent a tipping point, in your opinion, all of this, or not, from what you're hearing and seeing?
We'll only know if it's a tipping point in hindsight. There have been periodic protests in Iran, beginning in 1999 with student protests that were put down very quickly, then much more massively 10 years after that in 2009, when there were presidential elections which were tampered with to allow the preferred candidate of the supreme leader to win. And then again in 2017, in 2019, in 2022. So, with increasing frequency, we have seen these kinds of protests. People have lost hope in the ability of the Islamic Republic to reform itself. The supreme leader has shut down over and over again efforts by various officials to soften the hard edges of the regime. There was one exception, and we should mention this. In 2015, the Iranian government reached an agreement with the then Obama administration on Iran's nuclear program that eased sanctions on Iran very briefly. And this agreement was never really given a chance to...
This is the JCPOA.
Yeah, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Donald Trump was elected in November of 2016 the first time. That put a chill over it. And in May of 2018, he withdrew from the agreement and reimposed all the sanctions that had been suspended. I got a lovely note from a friend recalling what the atmosphere in Tehran had been like in 2014, 2015, even 2016, when Iranians were optimistic, when foreign business people were traveling there, when Boeing was about to sell airplanes, Airbus, and so on. And people really thought that they had turned a corner and that this was somehow a precursor to normalizing relations with the United States. And because of Donald Trump, that never happened. And, you know, we can speculate now if he'd never been elected, if Hillary Clinton had been the president, would we be in this situation? Be that as it may, I think since that time, you know, it's never really been able to recover that sense of optimism that existed in 2015, 2016.
Would Reza Pahlavi be one of the returning diaspora? Do you judge the son of the deposed Shah? There's been a lot of speculation about his extraordinary social media effort that has been put in. I mean, I personally have had people approaching me suggesting we interview him and they could get an interview with him. And apparently that's happening around the world. But now he's been calling on protesters to move in and take control of cities. Centres. Now, it's a bit of a mystery, isn't it, that this man, how do you judge his role?
You know, for now, I don't think his role is that big. He is a symbol, a nostalgic symbol for a lot of Iranians of a time when the country was accepted internationally. And so he has appeal, he has name recognition. If Iran were to change in the way I suggested, you know, he should be certainly welcome to return and participate in the life of the country if he wants to invest in it. He's got a lot of money he could bring back that was taken away by his family in 1979. He could run for office if he wanted. They could have a referendum and decide they want a constitutional monarchy. I mean, that's all within the realm of possibility. But for now, again, you know, he's urging people to go and put their lives down on the line and without any assurance that they're going to succeed. So it's troubling in some ways to me. And also some of his followers are extremely unpleasant to anyone who does not support Reza Pahlavi. They threaten people's lives. They say, oh, after the revolution, we'll come and get you. It's really despicable. And there's one other group that's even more despicable, and that's the Mujahideen Halk group called the MEK, which is an Islamist militant cult that lost out in the struggle for power after the revolution, but still has a following and a leader who's based in Paris. Very nice place to be. And they're also extremely unpleasant to each other. So you have a very fractious diaspora. And, you know, can these people actually bring something better to Iran? I put my faith in Iranians in Iran. I think they know what they want. They know what they need. These are the people who have endured 47 years of the Islamic Republic. And these are the people that will produce the leaders who can change the country if they're given an opportunity.
There's another very interesting observation I've heard made, that a lot of Iranians are well aware of the chaos that descended upon Libya, Afghanistan, even Syria now. They're taking a very close look. Iranians are very worried about chaos on their own streets, even though they loathe the regime. Do you put much credence on that sort of observation?
I do. I mean, I think that particularly older people, people who remember the revolution, who remember past protest movements, are being cautious. And we're seeing primarily young people who have no memory of any of this going out on the streets and risking their lives. Also, the fact that countries like Israel are actively fomenting protests and encouraging particularly separatists in places like Iranian Kurdistan to rise up. We have other groups in an area called Balochistan near the border with Pakistan and Afghanistan with another ethnic minority, Sunni Muslim ethnic minority, also being encouraged to rise up. So there's fear of the country splintering, and there is fear of civil war, which of course would be absolutely terrifying given...
Because there's tremendous factionalism, isn't there, in Iran? Tremendous factionalism, and has been so for years.
There is factionalism. I mentioned there is no clear leader for this movement.
Not even from the guards? Not if the Revolutionary Guards?
No.
150,000 of them, I might add.
Yeah, there's no clear leader at this point, apart from Ayatollah Khamenei, with all his many flaws. There are, some political prisoners who have a wide following in the country, but they don't necessarily have the kind of organization that would be required. And, I mean, we have to remember how the original revolution happened. It took almost 2 years. There was tremendous organization through the mosques, through university campuses, labor unions. It was a wide coalition that supported the overthrow of the Shah. We don't see that now. We absolutely don't. And the leader of the country at the time, the Shah, was reluctant to fire on crowds in a way that would cause mass casualties. I think something like 10,000 people died in the entire revolution. That was almost 2 years. And we have heard that 2,000 or 3,000 people have been killed just in 3 weeks in Iran. So this regime, having come out of a revolution, is much more willing to use brute force than the Shah was.
Thank you very much indeed for your time.
You're very welcome. Thanks for asking me.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jerry. I know you also spoke to Barbara a little bit about the human dimensions of all of this. I mean, we're all seeing, reading, hearing these unbelievable stories of the sort of human impact of this.
Oh, well, the tragedy of watching just one, that young man, the 26-year-old man who looks like, he's on death row and look, I'm sure he'll be killed ultimately. I found it just incredibly affecting. It just really hit me. But of course, I'm not a parent sitting there the way they are. But it is also worth saying that the region itself is just totally involved. Apparently enormous, intense lobbying by the region, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Qataris, to President Trump. They don't want conflagration in the regions. That's where I think we've got to follow. The story is going to be how the region also chooses to get involved.
Now, as we mentioned at the top of this episode, we are bringing you Global Roaming 5 days a week this year. It'll be on Radio National every morning at 11 a.m, again at 9 p.m, and of course in your podcast feed every single day. And in order to help us do that, Geraldine, we've enlisted some wonderful new hosts.
Yes, we have Latika Burke, based in London, and I think there's going to be a lot of stories coming out of London and Europe next year. And Carly Morris, who has joined us a few times on Global Roaming in the past. She's actually going to be presenting and producing somehow, Kylie.
Kylie, Latika, g'day. Welcome to Global Roaming.
Hello, hello. Such a pleasure to be here.
Now, how are you going to produce and present, Kyle?
Don't ask me that, Geraldine. With a great deal of goodwill and ambition and cooperation from my co-hosts, I think. Look, you know, the truth is that we all kind of live and breathe this in any case, in whatever form, right? So we're having these conversations amongst ourselves on air, off air. So I don't see it really as being that much of a shift between producing and presenting. I think for me, and certainly in my work over the past years, you know, I'm interested in centering that human story. So yeah, I'm thrilled to be part of the team and really looking forward to it.
Kylie, I can't move past the fact that you paused when you said years and you didn't put a number on it. Do you want to share with listeners how long you've been a foreign correspondent for? Because you've done a lot.
It just makes me feel tired if I add up the years. No, so I was, I started out with the ABC. I'm from Newcastle. I started out here. I went to background briefing at Radio National. And then went to London to study. And then I went over to the BBC. I ended up in Gaza as a BBC correspondent. And then I moved to Kabul again as a BBC correspondent. And then I went to Bangkok and covered Southeast Asia, jumped over to Channel 4 News, went back to London, and then ended up in Washington for 5 years and came back home to Australia in 2019. So I covered the initial rise of Trump and his first term.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to dissecting some of your background knowledge on all of those parts of the world. And Latika, obviously, you'll be familiar to
me. Okay, I feel very unqualified after that. Full disclaimer.
But look, you are a familiar voice and face to many of our listeners, but I think probably people know you best for your work as a political reporter in Canberra and covering Australian politics. But do you want to maybe fill in the gaps? Because you've actually now been overseas for quite a long time, doing much broader work.
Yeah, coming up 10 years now, and the world has so much changed since even I moved to London. I mean, it was 2016, and I like to say that Barack Obama was the president, David Cameron was the prime minister, and Britain was still in the European Union. That doesn't even feel like a few years ago. That feels like a lifetime ago. It feels like a world that we will one day tell people much younger than us used to exist, and they will wonder what kind of fantasy books we were reading or living in at the time. It's just so different. And through that, I think it's been a natural progression of what has both coincided with my interests, but also what has dominated the world and national security and geopolitics, particularly the rise of China, and then, of course, with the war in Ukraine, has really, I think, collided all of these topics into one big mishmash. And that is what I spend every single nearly minute that I'm awake now looking at. So it's a good place to do it from London because you have not only the proximity, but there's such a broad range of people and thoughts and ideas and ranges of think tanks and experts that come through this city. And you can really get caught up spending all your days, as Kylie would know, just tapping into some of the most fantastic minds.
Do you find that there is at the moment any clarity emerging? Like there seems to be a definite focus emerging about the importance of resilience, national resilience and security. And of course, we've got people in Europe in particular, like Mark Rutte, warning Europe they could be fighting Russia within 5 years. So this is a very different scene, isn't it?
Yes, compared to Australia, yes, but it is a mixed picture where you are in Europe. So if you're in Poland, the conversation's very different. They feel like they're preparing for a war on their border. If you're in Germany, you can see huge transitions there, and I think that's going to be a strong focus of global roaming this year. Here in Britain, actually, you have what I call quite a schizophrenic approach. On one hand, the government is very strong on Russia and Ukraine, and quietly they're doing a few things around the edges to try and improve societal resilience. So for today, for example, they expanded from 55 years of age to 65, the age of reservists that they will call up. So there's some tiny tinkering at the edges. But if you want to look at the steak in the middle of the sandwich, which is the amount that needs to be spent on rearming themselves, this is a conversation that is just not happening, not only in Britain, but across a lot of Western Europe. A lot of countries went to NATO last year.
In Australia too, Latika.
I know, I'm very familiar.
It's a conversation, it's the debate we have to have.
And they promised Donald Trump to raise their defence spending. I have not seen one jurisdiction, other than the ones that were already serious about their defence spending, and I'm talking in Europe here, actually outline how they're going to do it.
So listen, there's a huge job ahead of us this year, and we're just going to let listeners in on a little bit of what we've got planned. I've got some trips coming up. Geraldine's got some trips coming up. Latika, I know you do as well. So Kylie, can you kick us off? What do you want Global Roaming to give to listeners and to do in 2026?
Well, it's exciting, I think, under this new kind of scheme that we will be able to reach further, not only with our conversations, but physically. I know Latika is looking at, you know, trips to Eastern Europe and national security conferences, and I know you're looking at Southeast Asia. We are working across multiple time zones, which, you know, with my producer's hat on is slightly terrifying. But I think we can be more places. It's going to be more dynamic and it's going to be more conversational, and we'll be able to range more in our minds and physically. So it's going to be great.
Geraldine?
Yes, I suppose I'm really fascinated with some of the big elections. Like, I think the Israeli election is this year is just going to be simply critical. I'm hoping I can persuade powers that be to send me, because I just think it would be a fantastic piece to report. I'll tell you, I would love to, one of the other ways we were thinking of, who would we all most like to all interview?
Oh, yes. Who?
Well, you might be surprised to hear me say this, but I would love to land a big interview with Tony Blair.
Oh, yeah, I'm surprised. You've been wanting that since we started,
well,
Geraldine.
Well, I've said it to you, but I haven't said it out loud. And because I think from what one reads behind, he's, you know, I know people have been immensely divided about Tony Blair, but it seems to me that he is trying behind the scenes to really bring something like a two-state solution. I think this is his big act of redemption of self. That's what I see it.
Oh, and you're interested in the sort of spiritual dimensions of all of this.
Look,
as well.
You see, he's laughing. See, I can't even get away the first episode. I shall let listeners judge. That is my great dream.
Latika, yes, I think you're heading off to Ukraine soon, maybe the Munich Security Conference. What else have you got in store for us?
I'm hoping definitely to get back to Ukraine pretty soon. But in terms of dream interviews, okay, let's play fantasy. One person I'd love to see interviewed, if it wasn't us doing it, but anyone, Xi Jinping. I think sometimes we forget that he's actually never submitted himself to any kind of interrogation. I mean, Putin does. Trump certainly does. But in the realms of reality, you know, there's a really interesting character in the White House that not so many people pay so much attention to, at least in an interrogation form, and that's Jared Kushner, who I'm told is the real mover and shaker and power broker. So he's somebody I would like to hear from, precisely because you never hear from him very much. And when he did speak a couple of weeks ago in Paris at the Coalition of the Willing negotiations, I thought he was very, very impressive.
Okay, that's a great suggestion, Latika. So I'll look forward to...
What about you?
So look, I've got a bit on the cards this year. I've got this big trip coming up to Indonesia. So we're going to have a mini series on Indonesia. As well as that, I've got this new TV series coming out on the ABC about disinformation, a sort of post-truth world, because I think there's a huge amount going on. And we got lovely feedback about the Lydia Khalil essay in our summer series on that. I would really like us to land President Prabowo of Indonesia, Prabowo Subianto. He is a leader of consequence in our region. I think he doesn't fit neatly into some of the holes that we try and slot leaders of our region into. It is the big untapped, uncovered story of our region. I think you know how passionate I am do. About Indonesia. But I'm really looking forward to going back. And I hope that given the extended format that we'll be able to touch Southeast Asia a little bit more on Global Roaming. So going forward, we're actually hoping this Monday episode will be driven by you. We'd love to respond to more of your emails, suggestions, questions as well. So please keep them coming, global.roaming@abc.net.au. And I'll be back tomorrow with Kylie. What are we doing tomorrow, Kylie?
Staying in the region, talk about Myanmar. In fact, we're speaking to a democracy activist about the elections that are currently underway there, widely regarded as sham elections, favouring the junta. So it's important to us. It's a centre of instability in the region. We need to know better what's going on there.
Look, thank you all for joining us to kick off an eventful year, which I think we're all going to enjoy. Certainly we'll enjoy it together. So bye-bye for now.
Looking forward to it.
Thanks, Geraldine. Looking forward to it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.